Good morning, everybody. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Well, they've said for years that space is the final frontier. I think Captain Kirk initially coined that expression, and many people have said it since, and it has the added virtue of being true. So, for people like me who've enjoyed looking up at the night sky and wondering, I love the moment that's happening in our country right now. Because of the anniversary of the Apollo project, because of the space flights of Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos, you're seeing a renewed interest in the space program from government. You're seeing a renewed interest from the media, and you're seeing a renewed interest from the public. And as far as I'm concerned, that is a great thing. And I am just thrilled that we get to spend a full hour exploring some questions related to space with a man who knows about it, more about space than just about anybody that I've spoken to on the radio, and also sounds better than anyone that currently speaks on the radio. I'm talking about Dr. Sky, Steve Cates, a veteran radio and TV broadcaster and edutainer who with a great deal of expertise in astronomy and space. Steve, thank you as always for joining me at this early hour.
Well, Frank, it's a privilege and honor to be here on 77 WABC as we continue to talk about the things that are moving on to the infinite. And how right you are. I mean, this is such an amazing story that continues with the flights and privatization of space. But how about this? A little kick in the pants, something that maybe many people were not aware of. The FAA, right around the time that Jeff Bezos' flight took off with Blue Origin and the new Shepard capsule, they actually made some changes. And I'm kind of concerned about this because what they're doing basically is saying this. They're making a distinction between what a flight crew is and simply what spaceflight participants are. Now, this is kind of, you know, really upsetting the apple cart for many that believe once you go above 50 miles above the Earth, or that classic Kármán line, 60 miles, you would necessarily just get your astronaut wings. But now, the FAA is saying that you'll only be given, that's these guys, and maybe even the Branson flight, but the Branson flight was before the change, that now the people who are participants would probably only get what's called an honorary flight astronaut wing, because flight crews need to demonstrate, get a load of this, activities during flight that are essential to public safety or contributed to space flight safety. And what does that mean in simple English? It means that the travelers that were on board the Bezos flight, all they had to do was sit in the chair and strap in like you're going on an amusement park ride, because the whole flight was autonomous. So the FAA has control of the Commercial Astronaut Wings program. Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting, yeah. And we touched upon this a little bit last week, sure, when you were kind enough to join for a few minutes. But
yes,
the FAA sort of changing the definition of what it means, mm-hmm, to be an astronaut. A lot of people are going to look at that and say, well, look, you have people who've worked their whole lives, who've trained, who've gone,
correct,
through rigorous training process, who've been in the military, who've been scientists, who've been geologists. And they clearly deserve the label of astronaut. Why should someone who plunks down $24 million to be a guest on a space flight where they don't do, mm-hmm, anything, why should that person be given the same distinction as a John Glenn and Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin?
You said it right. That's their way of changing the whole thing. But what's interesting too, Frank, is that the Branson flight, which is a little bit different. I mean, this on their particular spacecraft that's dropped, as people know, from the mothership, it flies into space. But there are two pilots that are piloting this. But once again, in the back, in the passenger area, all you had to do was sit there and enjoy the ride. So if they're going to change this, not to split hairs with the audience here, and then just maybe with the FAA, of course, we're looking at a change that may come. But Branson may slip through the cracks with his. But stay tuned, right, because there's going to be more definitions of this as we move forward. But the big point, and I think that's the one that we have, you know, highlighted last week, what an amazing accomplishment. And that, I think, deserves a lot of attention and congratulations.
Now, I mentioned yesterday as I was promoting your appearance that I was surprised at what's happening with the International Space Station. For starters, I don't think a lot of people in our audience knew that the International Space Station was essentially going to be closing, and they're looking for a private company to do everything that the ISS, or, mm-hmm, formerly the Space Station Mir, used to do. why is the International Space Station closing, and do you see a private company stepping in to fill this void?
Well, the answer to that is pretty simple. The aging of this particular spacecraft, remember, we're looking back in the late 90s when the first modules were put up into and build this, what I call this big Lego block in the sky. And things are getting old, and they've had, as you know, people have reported, and people have heard this through the mainstream media, and on the internet they've read it, that little micrometeor particles have penetrated the hull, they've had oxygen leaks, they've had all kinds of things. But I just want to highlight, Frank, I think this is interesting to share with the audience here. There are literally 10, only 10 humans right now in space. Two Russians on board the International Space Station, one astronaut from France, and of course one from Japan, and three Americans, particularly one woman. But as we continue on with this, there's a module that was actually detached from the International Space Station called the PIRS. It's one of the PIRS. It's one of the older modules that used it's used for experimentation, and they detached it, and they're making room. I don't know if it's attached yet. I mean, I haven't gotten that information yet or intel, but there's something called the Nauka module, which is built in Russia, and it's going to reattach itself. So what I'm saying in simple English is that this particular unit is getting old. They were looking at maybe even turning this into a hotel in space in the future, and that's maybe not out of the question. But new design, see, the Russians are getting very, the Roscosmos, Russian space agency, is starting to have a little political friction with the United States. They've always had a little bit, but more so now with tensions that are going, you know, behind with the State Department and things going on in the political world. The Russians simply want to put up their space station. The Chinese are doing that. There's three Chinese Tikhonauts, as we call them, aboard the Tiangong 1 as it's flying and sailing through space. This particular object has three astronauts, if you want to call that. So I think the simple answer is there's a lot of stuff out there where companies and space agencies want to continue and develop new ones. But on the side of privatization, I wouldn't be surprised if you have people like, you know, Bezos, of course, putting things up. Robert Bigelow wants to put up this inflatable-type, balloon-type space station, a smaller one. But the problem with these things, when they get as big as the International Space Station, it becomes such a big and kind of ungainly thing. And what goes up, Frank, you know, and everybody knows, must come down. And through the program, I wanted to highlight, if we have some time maybe later with your okay, I wanted to give everybody in this audience an opportunity to know of a couple of passages of the International Space Station. One will, of course, occur early tomorrow morning as we move through time and space. And we can go over those, of course, if you want, a little later to describe the times, because some of these passages are incredibly bright. And I know the audience out there, I mean, I get a lot of emails from all the different shows we do, and people are usually, the top thing on their list is, hey, I want to know how to see these space objects that are sailing through the night sky. Well, we pick the big one, the ISS.
So what are the implications of this? We've seen, it seems like, the space program in the United States is becoming increasingly a private sector enterprise. What are the implications of the ISS going away and NASA seeking a private sector replacement? Is this good? Is this bad? Or is the jury still out as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think you have to give NASA a lot of credit, but unfortunately they haven't been in the news as much as they probably should from all the great things like you opened up with the Apollo program, with Apollo 11's anniversary, hard to believe, what, 52 years ago. But let's highlight a little bit of what NASA's trying to do. And a lot of people don't really know this, and this is quite interesting. Their project to go to the moon is known as Artemis. And what they're looking to do, they have on the design, they're going to be testing this, another incredibly powerful rocket, probably as tall as the Saturn V was in its day, some 365 feet in that kind of category, a monster rocket. Of course, Elon Musk is going to do more with his heavy lift, have heavy rockets that he's sending up. But what's interesting, if you look at NASA's program, they're going to look at building a space station. How about this? A lunar space station, Frank, around the moon called Gateway. And why is this important? Because remember the days, of course, and you know, I'm old enough, maybe the listeners, of course, actually participated in watching many of these moon missions that went to the surface. The astronauts were at grave danger if something would have happened. Look at Apollo 13. So now what we're saying is not only do we want to go back to the moon with advanced lunar modules and maybe lunar, you know, surface moving craft on the surface, you know, craft that can move around and drive on the surface like the old Apollo rovers, they're going to have something in lunar orbit. So if there's any need to go back in a safe zone, they're going to have something there. But it's also interesting that the Artemis project calls for America to send its first female astronauts to the moon. And there's a couple, there's like nine women that may be first on the moon. And this is all supposed to take place. I know it sounds a little bit early for many believe that, you know, where do we get the money for this with all the projects that the government now is trying to do? Infrastructure, you know, we're basically, what, bankrupt in many ways, ask the average person on the street.
Sure.
And I would kind of agree. But the thing, I think the implications are you're going to see a big space race again. You know, Bezos, of course, doing this Blue Origin is not his only project with New Shepard. He wants to build spacecraft that will go to the moon. But I think the most viable, in my opinion, of anybody that's going to do it is what's happening in Boca Chica down in southern Texas, where, of course, Elon Musk is launching the, you know, the Starliners, the spacecraft that eventually will go around the moon and maybe go on, of course, as the ultimate goal. The Starship, I should say, go all the way and land on the surface of Mars. So we have some very interesting competition coming. But to sum it up in average terms, I think we're looking, Frank, at seeing privatization is going to be the mother's blood. And just like money is the mother's blood of politics, I think it's going to go maybe even faster than a government and many governments that really can't sustain this. And a lot of the public that maybe, you know, we love space, but ask the average person on the street about this, and they're going to argue as they have, and maybe they have a good point. Maybe there should be other things that people should spend the money on. But we're here just to educate, and I love continuing on.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. You can check out some of his blog, his musings on any variety of subjects in this realm by going to ktar.com. He's got a terrific blog on there that covers a lot of subjects, for ranging to what you can see in the night sky to what they're doing in space. It's a blog that I go to and check regularly. I steal a lot of show topics from there. It's absolutely terrific.
Well, thank you.
Steve, and by the way, if people have questions, we'll do our best to take them. 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. If you have a question related to space, the space program, or astronomy, or what you can see in the night sky in the short term or in the long term. Steve, we've already mentioned Jeff Bezos a couple of times mm-hmm. now. And when you were
yes.
kind enough to come on last Thursday, we gave folks
Absolutely.
A little bit of a primer into mm-hmm. exactly what they had done on this Blue Origin 4-minute space flight. Mm-hmm. For people that have only been following this with passing interest, what exactly did Jeff Bezos do? Where did he go? How did the ship work? What were the kind of top line need to knows on what Jeff
sure.
Bezos did?
The backstory on this with Blue Origin is, of course, they've had many test flights that were successful to get the capsule itself to get up there, the New Shepard. And for those of you that didn't hear this or are interested, of course, and I know you are, the New Shepard is obviously going as the advanced version of what Alan Shepard did, the first American to go into space. And that's a good definition. And I'm sorry to be repetitive if some of the listeners heard this, but maybe somebody wasn't hearing it. And here we go. Back in 1961, America had so many test flights of their rockets, the Redstone, the little rocket. If you saw it today, you'd look and go, wow, that's a tiny little rocket compared to what we have today. But they had so many explosions, and some of those campy B science, you know, sci-fi movies, they usually show these rockets exploding on the launch pad. We had so many attempts to try to get rockets to work right. So the Paperclip group, as the Wernher von Braun group, the Peenemünde scientists that we either captured or brought here to the United States, they developed the V-2 rocket down in White Sands. But it was a great accomplishment to have Alan Shepard go on this little tiny capsule and do the flight that what Jeff Bezos kind of replicated. What did he do? Alan Shepard was launched. He went up into space. He went up probably, I don't have the exact mileage, but above that 50-mile mark. He didn't orbit the Earth as Yuri Gagarin did. That was an amazing feat even before John Glenn. But what Bezos did, I mean, you got to give credit to this technology. It's autonomous. So you and I, if we were asked to go, well, Frank, I'd have to maybe borrow some money from you. that would be interesting to go to space. But again, we're being ludicrous here. Imagine $28 million to go up for a 10 or 11-minute flight. But you notice they didn't have spacesuits on. This is very interesting. You know, you look at the old Apollo astronauts or even astronauts like Shepard and Glenn. They're in these very elaborate pressure suits built by people like Hamilton Standard. And they have environmental control systems. Look at the Apollo astronauts. Remember, we see Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins walking down to the little tiny SUV, the little RV that took them to the launch thing. They have these oxygen and air conditioners that they're carrying. Well, these guys on this flight, what did they do? They just walked out in these really cool-looking Star Trek kind of outfits, no pressure suits at all. You get strapped in the seat, And what was amazing, and of course I haven't seen the capsule up close, I mean, that would be an honor to see it, but they have some of the most amazing windows, large windows. You get strapped in the chair, and somebody else behind the curtain, as they say, is doing all the launch procedures, and it sounded like artificial intelligence. You know, you start it, it checks the weather, it checks the systems on the rocket, and Godspeed, like they say, ad astra, to the stars. They get launched up to, and obviously the flight that Bezos made, they say was upwards of about 66 miles higher than what Branson did, which allegedly he was probably in the low 50s. But it's still amazing, but the cost per pound, imagine what the cost per pound is to fly somebody to space.
No, I can't. I can't. You know, when I was talking to this about this flight in advance of it occurring with my sister, and I was explaining who was going to be on the flight with Jeff Bezos and the fact that they're going to have the oldest astronaut present, an 82-year-old woman who'd been training for this for a while.
Wally Funk. Right?
My sister mentioned, yeah, you know, she probably would have liked to have been in space for more than 4 minutes. And a lot of people have asked why this flight was only 4 minutes. Why couldn't they have taken a longer stroll around the suborbital area?
Well, great question, because it's still, and I hate to use the word, I don't want to, you know, convince the audience that this is experimental. I mean, there's great dangers. But its intent and purpose is just to go up for a short time, go beat that so-called line in space so you can claim astronaut status, and then give the world, who can afford to pay it, the most amazing amusement park-type ride that you can ever imagine. But the thing is, the rocket wasn't capable of pushing that particular craft higher up into space, because remember, it separates. And the booster rocket, which is, again, this is something even more amazing that people probably didn't pick up on. Just like Elon Musk, when I saw the return of the launch rocket, the booster rockets, like his Falcon 9s, and this, you know, and this obvious rocket that launched the crew on board Bezos' flight, part of the excitement to me was watching the rocket, the body, come back to Earth at great speed, stabilizing itself. And doing what, Frank? Firing a retro rocket to almost land in the center of a bullseye. Mm. But once you're released in the capsule, you've got maybe, what, 3-4 minutes of weightlessness because you're above that gravity area. And then another thing is that little capsule has to orientate itself down, and that ride must still be a pretty bad G-flight if you're not used to it coming through there, until eventually, how do we land? All American flights up till recently, and I think even, well, I shouldn't say this, I'll correct myself. American flights, we all know, return to the Earth landing in the water. Russian space flights were traditional to always land on the Earth. So now we have an American capsule coming down from great velocity, using a parachute system and little rockets to stabilize it, and going from super, you know, sonic speeds all the way down to, I think they said something like 7 or 8 miles per hour, and making a dust splotch in the desert. And then you open the door and you say, wow, that was a hell of a ride.
That is for sure. Talking with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. If you want to comment or ask Dr. Sky a question about space, 800-848-9222 is our telephone number. That's 1-800-848-WABC. I have a number of things we're going to ask Dr. Sky about as we continue this hour. But I have a question for you in the meantime, and that's, why have you not yet ordered Life Change Tea? Do you not want your life to change for the better? I mean, come on. Things could be a little bit better, can't they? Now, the first way and the best way to begin that process is through Life Change Tea. What does Life Change Tea do? It gives you a ton of energy without caffeine. It also helps get all the junk out of your body, out of your digestive tract. You can learn more by going to the website getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. You know, recently I learned the term get the tea is basically a young person's term for catching up with another person. I had no idea. The website's even more clever than I realized. But you can go to getthetea.com, order some of this Life Change Tea. It's all natural. It's completely organic, no fillers, no GMOs. And if you order some, you can use the promo code Frank and get free shipping anywhere in the United States. So getthetea.com is the website. You can go to the promo code Frank and enjoy free shipping. Now, they sell some other supplements on there as well. And whatever you order on through the other supplements is also going to include free shipping if you use the promo code Frank. That's the catch. GetTheTea.com, a great product, and promo code Frank gives you a great price. Straight ahead.
scalp and caressed your brain.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. That is Lords. Spending the hour with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. He is an expert on all things related to what's in the sky. You want to follow him and learn more about what he's doing and the subjects he's commenting on, go to ktar.com. There's some great programs on there. He also has a great blog on there as well. We'll take your questions at 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. We'll begin with Tony in Rockland County. Hello there, Tony.
Hello.
Oh, sorry. Good morning. I actually disconnected, Tony, as I was trying to put you back up as well, Dr. Sky. So, Tony, call back. So I'm sure Tony will be back in a second. But the Jeff Bezos flight and other similar Blue Origin flights that take place that we were talking about, how do these flights work without an aviator on board?
Well, that's a good question. And like I said before, it's all autonomous. And they've tested this about 15 times. So let's say in the little mission control that they have, and I don't really know where that is, Frank. I mean, I've tried to do as much investigative journalism on this other than go there. And maybe that's one day you'll get that from me. If hopefully we'll get out to the location and both at the Branson location in southern New Mexico. But this is all autonomous. So as I understand it, let's say there's a room with computers and advanced, hardware and software. You launch this particular rocket all autonomously. Everything on there, including the thrust for the rockets, is all controlled, metered and measured. It's all predicted to go to a certain height, and everything happens in accordance with what's going on. But here's one thing that I never, ever got an answer to, and I've asked a lot of people in the space industry. Just like the Apollo space capsule, I mean, there's Apollo space, the Saturn V with the Apollo astronauts. They had an escape system on the top of that if something were to have happened. Because imagine the amount of power in an explosive force if that Saturn V ever exploded on the launch pad, like the Russian N1 rocket. That's why they never went to the moon like we covered it last week. I don't know what safety systems were even on board, and I presume they had them. But there was never anything that I knew that said, well, if the launch is detected as not having enough thrust, let's say it starts at full power, and all of a sudden it starts to yaw because there's less power to some of the engines or the engines, what was the emergency escape system on there? I guess you pop the capsule off and you come down with parachutes? I don't know that.
You got me. All right, we're going to give another try to Tony in Rockland County. Sorry about that, Tony. That was on me.
Morning, Tony.
Good. I make a proposal. Hello?
Yeah, we're here. We actually just disconnected Dr. Sky now, so we're going to try and reconnect
I make a proposal.
Him.
Rachel, is it? Rachel, that you put her in a capsule and birthed on the moon, and you have the first child born on the moon. And were you surprised if you lifted the veil and it wasn't Leia?
I think you lost me on that one.
I'm sorry about that. I had to say something goofy like that.
All right.
Good night, sir.
Thank you, Tony. 800-848-WABC. Let's say hello to Joe here in New York City. Joe, what is your question for Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky? Hello there, Joe.
Now, the two gentlemen, multi-billionaires, right, who banned our President Trump, right? Now, what in percentages, what would be the percentage, right, of them getting killed while up there?
Well, it's a good question, Joe, and I really don't know the answer to that statistically. I'm not, not to be nasty here, I'm not the rocket builder, but the truth of the matter is, like I was mentioning to Frank before, I'm sure they have some safety systems on there. I'm not sure the ones that are on board the Blue Origin as in any detail, but they do have some escape systems that Branson has with the space plane that they had, and they've also had a series of incidents and one where they lost, series of fatal crash before they got to the level that they are right now. So I'm not sure what those percentages would be, but there is some safety factors built into this.
Would Bezos or Mr. Branson come down on parachutes, for example?
The Branson flight comes back as a space plane. It actually lands. It goes up into space once it's deployed. It fires its rocket. It goes up to altitude. It arcs up over the top. They call it the apogee. They get an opportunity to be weightless for a short period, a few minutes. The wing system on board the Branson space plane has to configure its wings so that it can turn back and come back as an airplane. So the Branson spacecraft comes back and lands on a runway, just like you and I would land in a commercial plane.
That's interesting.
Right. But
they don't need any specific training at all.
No, I shouldn't say that. The Branson flight, there's a program that you go through, and I'm sure they have a chief astronaut trainer. They do a program where I'm sure they take you through some elaborate, measures to make sure you're safe. And I'm sure the Bezos flight, they told people how to maybe get out of the craft if it had a problem. But finishing up, Joe, with the Bezos flight, obviously that comes down by parachute and landed on the surface of the Earth, a much different way to return from space, similar to what the Russians have done for so long.
Thank you,
wow.
Joe. Do we know, Steve, when the next one of these is? It was made clear that this was not going to be a one and done. Do we know when either the next Blue Origin or Virgin Galactic space flight is going to take place?
Again, Frank, not with any real specificity. From what I've read, I think we're looking at probably sometime in September or October, but that date could change. Because I think now what they're going to be doing is they're going to be perfecting every minor thing that they didn't think went well with that flight. But I couldn't see any measurable problems or nothing was announced. So you're probably looking at about a 3 or 4 month period before they do this. And again, the spacecraft and space plane that Richard Branson is using out of the southern New Mexico location there, I think they're going to probably be joining us, going back to space probably within the next couple of months, too, with a whole new set of people that are just itching to get up there. Because remember, Branson has been collecting down payments. And I think his flights, if you think about it, are much more economical. And I don't know if they raise the prices. I really got to dig into this. So the next time we talk, I may even get the opportunity to get out to one of the launches. And, Frank, it'd be nice to do this live on air, don't you think, of the night
absolutely.
Before? Absolutely. We could have some fun.
Do we know anything about the fella that bid $24 or $28 million to be on the Blue Origin flight, then all of a sudden said they had a scheduling conflict? I mean, that's some scheduling conflict.
That's a hell of a scheduling conflict. I don't really know much of the backstory there, but obviously the same price was paid for that precious seat. So they sent the nephew, the 18-year-old physics student from the Netherlands, who was obviously beaming from one end of his mouth to the other. I mean, wouldn't that be amazing? Imagine when we were 18 years old, if somebody said, hey, Frank, you guess where you're going to go? You're going to fill in for my seat and you're going to go up into space. I'd think, wait a second. I'm in another alternate reality, right?
No, I can imagine. I can imagine. Now, Jeff Bezos indicated that he's already sold $100 million worth of tickets. Now, how are people buying these tickets? Can you go online and buy a ticket for a future space flight right now?
I don't think you can. And let's change the subject just for a moment to make this very clear. Bezos, I don't think, has offered what Branson has offered. And if you go on to going back to Richard Branson, he decided out of the niceness of the space, the future of space travel, he has this opportunity where you can go on to his website, and that is Richard Branson for Virgin Galactic, and they're offering two seats. But what you have to do is you have to pay a small amount of money to get a number of seats, and they raise the price up. I think it could be like $1,000. You get, 1,000 tickets. But I haven't heard anything what Bezos is doing on that. But, there was a lot of controversy, and I thought it was pretty sad. I mean, I'm not a billionaire. I don't know your status, but let's say that.
A long way away from there.
Yeah, well, I'm being right, obviously, but God bless the billionaires. They've created their wealth, and they deserve to be able to do what they want with it. But there were so many nasty comments about Jeff's flight saying, I hope he doesn't come back. But I think in this case, Frank, and I think you would agree, maybe it's time we just separate whatever we think about whether the guy does things right with Amazon. And then he was held to task by saying things about, if it wasn't for all the Amazon people and all you folks out there, you made it possible. I guess it's very, you're stepping in a minefield when you go from that because of the inordinate expense right now. But kind of putting this in perspective and finality, it's that I think the Branson side of the equation is much more affordable if you think that they were charging or looking at doing $250,000. And I don't know about you, but that's still a lot of money to me personally, but it's still not $28 million.
That is for sure. You mentioned a couple of the differences in terms of pricing and in terms of the differences between the Branson flight and Virgin and the Bezos flight with Blue Origin. Are there any other key differences between what these two billionaires did and how their flights actually went into space?
Well, other than the technology to get there, like I mentioned before, the Branson flight is based on the old, in my opinion, and it's pretty simple to agree with this, the old X-15 type flight technology back in the late 1950s. Neil Armstrong, Pete Knight, you know, I've had interviews with a number of these X-15 pilots, never Neil Armstrong, though. They would go on this, they would have the small little rocket plane, the X-15, under the wing of a B-52 called the High and Mighty. And if you look at some of these movies, I think there was a movie with Charles Bronson called X-15. I've got it in my video archive where they go through this in great detail. So Branson has basically had a, you know, kind of this evolution of doing a modern version of what the old flight was with the B-52 and the X-15. Because have you seen the pictures? I'm sure you have, and I'm sure the listeners have, of this amazing craft that goes up to space that drops the actual space plane. That's a Burt Rutan or Rutan design. And remember, the Rutan family is very famous because one of the Rutans went around the world with Gina Yeager in that Voyager craft. And I remember talking to him at one of the big Reno air races. But it's so amazing, Frank, that if you look at that technology, what Richard Branson is doing, it's really a cool technology. And to me, if I had my choice, I think I'd rather go up on the Branson flight. But that's just personal because you come back as if you're flying in an aircraft and not necessarily the thrust of the rockets that go onto the Bezos flight with the Blue Origin and the New Shepard.
We're talking with Steve Cates. If you have a question, give us a call, 1-800-848-WABC. You alluded to some of the controversy surrounding Jeff Bezos. There have been a lot of people criticizing both of these folks, Branson and Bezos, criticizing this whole thing as being a symbol of income inequality, saying, well, maybe these guys shouldn't be spending money to go to space. Maybe they should be spending money to clean the ocean or do X, Y, Z. Understanding what you just said about these billionaires earn their money, they should be able to spend it on whatever they want. What do you make of that argument that maybe there's money better spent improving the Earth than going to space?
Well, I think that's an argument that, you know, I don't necessarily totally agree with that. I think if I was a billionaire, and I think let's give Bezos some credit too, I understand that he gives a tremendous amount of money to, quote, charities. And I guess whether that's from his heart or whether his accountant says he should do it, regardless, he's giving something back. But I think we need this, Frank. I mean, really, truly, and I don't want to get so philosophic here that, you know, maybe I go off the deep end here, but I'm a big fan like you are. Obviously, that's why we're here on the radio talking about this. But I think this is a great thing for young people to get some sort of inspiration. And let's go back to all this. What are we doing now as a country? God forbid we're going back into this next wave of COVID and we're looking at cities locking down. And I don't know about you, but that was probably one of the worst years I ever had from my own personal business. And I'm not embarrassed to admit it. And things are coming back. But don't you think, and I think you would agree, that we need some sort of a positivity thing?
Oh, absolutely.
Out there.
I was,
and this is awesome.
I was all for this. And I've been critical of Jeff Bezos myself, but I love what he's doing here. Where does space begin?
The official number as far as altitude, NASA goes with the 50-mile mark. The technicals that really go behind that say that there's a line in space called Kármán line from one of the scientists, and they claim it's 60 miles up. But let me define something here, and I think this is interesting because it maybe segues to some of the things that people can see in the sky, and I think they'll be fascinated to hear this. In our multi-layered atmosphere, Frank, we start off with the troposphere. We go from 0 to 16 kilometers above the ground. This is obviously the area in which our tallest mountains are, the weather. This is where the weather on the Earth is. When you see thunderstorms, it's in pretty much the troposphere. Take this analogy. Take an apple, and if you held it, and that's the entire Earth, the skin on the apple would be the thinness or thickness, I should say, of how much the weather system or troposphere is. Above that is something we call the stratosphere. That's 16 to 50 kilometers above the ground. That's where most airplanes fly. The ozone layer is located there. But beyond that, most people don't recognize this. There's something called the mesosphere. It's 50 to 80 kilometers above the ground. Temperatures drop tremendously because it contains little ozone and matter to absorb heat. So it's one of the coldest areas. And this is where meteors as we see in the sky. And I'd like to mention, if there's time, about this big shower that's coming
up. Yeah.
And then we have the thermosphere. And not to conduct astronomy 101 here on the show, but that's 90 to, say, 500 kilometers up. This is the hottest layer of the atmosphere. But what's so important about it is that it filters out gamma rays and X-rays from the sun. So we're blessed that we have this protective layer, which is way out there in space. And then comes the amazing thing called the exosphere, 500 to 10,000 kilometers out. This is an area where that almost has no matter, and satellites orbit in this layer. So what I'm saying is, when we go up into space, we're going up, let's say, into the mesosphere. So that's where space begins, at about 50 miles above the Earth. And think of that. If you took from where you're sitting at the 77 WABC studios in New York City and just drew a line like a ruler 50 miles out, obviously people that are living in the suburbs, they're listening to the show and all over the country. But if you took that line and went straight up in the sky, it really truly isn't that high, don't you think? I mean, it's really not that far up to get there. But to get there, it takes a lot of energy and a lot of skill. Because if you do it wrong, you either don't get there because your rocket goes off course and that's fatal, or you come back and then you start to eventually burn up because your body starts moving through because of the pull of the Earth. But things like the space station are upwards of about, say, 265 miles, which is still considered to be low Earth orbit. And if you ask the experts on this, how much space junk is really there, you'd be surprised at this answer. The European Space Agency, Frank, says that, get a look at this, there are some 29,000 pieces of something, meaning flecks of paint, parts of spacecraft that are 10 centimeters or larger. Here comes the next crazy number. There's 670,000 pieces of junk or whatever in space that are one centimeter or larger. And then here comes the dangerous one. There's 170 million pieces of space debris that are at least a millimeter in size. And if you remember the George Clooney Gravity movie,
sure.
If you remember the part where that debris from an exploded spacecraft, it's like getting hit by a shotgun blast at 17,000 miles an hour. So even that area above where Bezos went, I mean, that area is pretty, you know, there's not much up there at all. That's an interesting story unto itself. So there's a lot of junk up there and a lot of good spacecraft, but it's getting way too crowded in many people's opinions.
Let's say hello to Joe in Jamaica. Joe, you are on with Dr. Sky.
Good morning,
Joe. Good evening, gentlemen. Good evening.
Thank you.
Having read, you know, what the FAA said and so forth about astronauts, I have a quick question. Suppose Bezos and Delta and Branson teamed up to make a spacecraft that they could, you know, work with. What would it look like? What would it do?
That's a good question, because I think they'd be pulling in two different directions, because they're two different types, Joe. You know, one is a space plane that you just blast a big rocket, like you go up and imagine that ride. You just go up at a steep angle. But the one that they're talking about with Bezos that we're talking about is literally a rocket that goes straight up. I don't know about that. I mean, combining the two, I think, would be a little bit counterintuitive, because both of them have kind of a different way to get to space. But again, I'm a big fan of these space planes. And I think, you know, if I had a vote, I think Bezos is doing something cool. But I think it's, to me, more of an exciting thing to be able to launch after you're dropped from an airplane, and then you go up to space, and then come back and land as if you went on a regular commercial airliner.
The one thing...
On a related note, how come the U.S. doesn't continue with the shuttle?
Well, here's the answer. It was a funding thing. And I remember being down, Joe and Frank, down in Florida at the Kennedy Space Center for the very last launch of the space shuttle. And I never saw a space shuttle launch before, but why I'm telling you that is that it was so incredible, but so expensive. And through all the hardship and the loss of life that they had, overall, the space shuttle did an amazing thing. But we recognized that the technology there is all it was, is a big glider, and it did amazing things. But now what we're looking to do is get away from having those big rockets that we had on there, on the shuttle. And we're looking to go and have aircraft or spacecraft that actually can go from the ground. And guys, I think, I can't prove this, but I think if you watch Tom Cruise's new movie that's coming out with Top Gun, there's a special rocket plane that they call Dark Star in there. What am I alluding to? Mm-hmm. I think the future, and I think we already have it. I think that's why they got rid of the SR-71. They shouldn't have. I think we have some secret craft that can go from the ground, guys, launch itself like a regular aircraft would go, and go to space and return. And I'm excited to try to prove that, because I think the technology is there. And maybe that's the answer, Joe. Maybe we get something like that that goes right from the ground. You get in and you go.
Thank you, Joe. You know, one of the people that we have not touched upon so far is Elon Musk and his SpaceX program. What's happening with that? What is the latest with that as far as you're aware?
Well, his whole Starship program, I think, is really cool. Because down in Boca Chica, way down there in southern Texas, his big problem over the last year has been to try to get this particular beautiful 1950s sci-fi looking rocket to be able to launch. They went up to about 50,000 feet, 60,000 feet. And to the eyes of the world, what did we see? He went up. They had to get FAA approval on this, of course. They launched and they tried to turn this rocket back or around so that it would do exactly what his Falcon 9 boosters did, and that is come down and soft land right in the center of the bullseye. He's finally perfected that. But hopefully once that gets going, I think that's going to take leaps and bounds. And you're right, we haven't talked about Musk. And I think without a doubt, you know, I'll give him I'll tip my hat to him. I think that's still the most advanced genius of rocket technology that we've seen since the days of Wernher von Braun. And it's amazing to see what he's going to be doing, because get set, there's going to be a gigantic, super big booster rocket that's going to be launching, and they're going to put that prototype, that Starship, up on the top, the Starship itself. That's the way we're going to get up to the moon. That's the way we're going to get to Mars. And I believe, seriously, Frank, he's serious as a heart attack of doing this, and I think he'll succeed.
We've been hearing, speaking of the moon, we've been hearing a lot about something called moon wobble. Which is something that we've been warned could actually cause a dramatic increase in coastal flooding here on Earth. What exactly is moon wobble, and how will that contribute
to
coastal flooding?
Well, let me jump on this one. It's the same complaint that I have, and every once in a while I have complaints like a human being too, and here it is. In the world of journalism, I wonder sometimes why every week we get to hear huge asteroid headed toward the Earth. Right. And it comes to us, in my opinion, doing this in journalism, I don't know your opinion and the listeners, it comes to me as almost like a scare thing, because it's like, well, this asteroid's going to come close, you know, boo, it's the size of a giant Eiffel Tower or the size of a Empire State Building, but oh no, it's not going to hit us. But here we go with the moon wobble. This is another thing that I think is taken out of context. The moon wobble has been known since 1728. And what it is, it's actually called precession, or something even more technical, called a libration. And I watch the moon, like many people, with the telescope, and every once in a while you can see around the edges of the moon, because the moon is doing this wobble back in the sky over the course of a month. But Frank, the simple answer about the moon wobble is that it has an 18.6-year precession in which it moves around in the sky, and the reason people are hearing that this moon wobble could affect the tides is now this time in history, it'll change again. We're on the amplified side of the wobble. So with any of this rising of the sea naturally or not naturally because of, you know, climate change or whatever people want to believe, it will add maybe a couple of inches, maybe to a couple of feet in the future. If the continuance of the climate change goes and the seas start to rise, you could see some theoretical coastal flooding. But they're not saying that this will take effect really until the 2030s. So if you live right near the ocean, you're probably already aware that we have this particular thing called nuisance floods, in which we get all throughout the year where we get above normal tides, and that we get every day, we get a spring tide twice a day because of the sun and the moon's alignment. So I think simply in perspective, this moon wobble has been known for such a long time, but in many articles I've read, I don't know, did you read the same, did you get the same inflection?
Yeah.
It's like, hey, the flood is coming and you better move to high.
Yeah, get on your ark. Hopefully you have two animals, grab on your ark.
Right.
800-848-9222. Ted is in Forest Hills. Ted, what's your question for Steve Cates?
No, thank you very much. I always appreciate when the doctor's on.
Thank you, sir.
I'm concerned about the James Webb telescope. It's been stalled for quite a while. Do you think it will go up soon?
I hope so. And thank you for the call, Joe. This is the perspective and the latest information that I have. Obviously, it's got a 21-foot mirror in it. And I know that the model traveled around the country and people looked at it. I didn't see it, but I saw pictures. It's this monstrous thing. It makes the Hubble look like it's a tiny little telescope. That has a 94-inch mirror. But here's the issue. It's hard to get that spacecraft to fold up like a transformer for a rocket that can actually send it to space. And they're going to do this in French Guiana aboard a French Ariane rocket. And it's scheduled to go up, and this latest I heard, at the end of October. I think it's actually on Halloween. How about that? And that will not be a spacecraft that orbits as low as the Hubble. This is going to be way out there in space. But just think about this, a 21-foot mirror.
The Lagrange point, yeah.
That's right, absolutely. The Lagrange point where it's now going to have what we call this basic, for the lack of technical information, it'll be at this fixed point where it'll be up there and it can do its thing in space far away from the Earth, far away from the light and energy and radio interference. And it'll be quite interesting, but the backstory of it is, and this is kind of spooky, is that there was an alert put out there because it has to be shipped down there to South America. And they were saying, I'm not trying to give anybody ideas, that there was a high percentage of piracy on the seas. Could you imagine somebody capturing that and holding it ransom? That's not a good story to be reading in your favorite internet news or whatever kind of newspaper you might read.
All right, 800-848-9.
Thanks, take care. God bless.
Thank you, Ted.
Thank you, Ted. 800-848-9222. Let me ask you about, speaking of the moon, this full buck moon that we saw on Friday, last Friday. It looked big. It looked red. Why was it such an unusual sight?
Well, we had a few of these so-called supermoons, Frank, in the early part of the year. This wasn't one. But the most amazing fact is when you get the moon coming to full phase, at or around the time within, say, hours of when the moon is at a position called perigee, or the closest it is to the Earth for that month, earlier in the year, we had what we call a supermoon. And by the way, a supermoon is not an astronomy term. It's actually an astrological term. But for the lack of a long description, it's the alignment of the perigee and the full moon timing. But this one, even though it's beautiful, don't all full moons look beautiful when they're rising? Because obviously the atmospherics appear to make it look larger than it really is. That's an illusion, by the way. I know that's hard to believe. But this buck moon is quite fascinating. But as we move into next year, we're going to have another series of these so-called supermoons that are actually closer. And I know we have a couple that are coming up in the next few years that are like almost record-breaking close moons. Nothing to be alarmed about, but just something to take in and, as they say, absorb the beauty and suck it in because it's an amazing thing.
Oh, that is absolutely for sure. You alluded to the meteor shower earlier.
Yes.
You wrote on your blog, which people can read at ktar.com, that this could be the creme de la creme of meteor showers. This might be the best meteor shower we see for quite some time. When is this meteor shower? How can people view it? And what makes this one so special?
Very good questions. It's the Perseids, and it's actually starting now, but unfortunately the moon is still bright in the sky. Where to look in the northeast sky after midnight? Best time, starting on the night of August the 8th when the moon is new. The moon will be out of the sky. You won't have to worry about that. Whatever you can do within the most powerful city in America, getting away from as much lights as you can, that's the task. But it all comes from, Frank, a comet we call Comet Swift-Tuttle. And it was discovered by two gentlemen, the name Swift and the name Tuttle, last names. Back on July 16, 1862, and July the 19th of 1862, this is an amazing object that spews out lots of meteors. So with the darker skies, with no moon, and the proximity of seeing this particular shower as the orbit of this comet intersects the Earth, here it is. Look to the northeast sky anytime after midnight into dawn, the best meteor shower you'll probably see of the whole year. But on an amazing end story on this, the nucleus of this comet is 16 miles allegedly in diameter. Now, that may not seem big to people, but that's large for a comet. And this comet, of all objects, this is, I didn't make this up, it's, quote, and I quote, the most dangerous object known to humanity. What does that mean? It means that all throughout history, the repetition of the nucleus coming near the Earth, it comes within a very close proximity to the Earth. And astronomers have said, and I don't want to be bad internet journalism, like I said with some of those, you know, asteroid information, blogs and such, but that this particular object probably won't hit the Earth anytime soon. It'll be very bright, and I know we won't be here to see it, in the year 2126, and it will get within a million miles of the Earth in the year 3044 AD. So all the listeners out there, after they listen to your show in its finality this morning, they can put their head to the pillow and feel rest assured that there's probably not much to worry about other than take a look at it, because the debris you see is indeed this particular material that comes off the nucleus. And in the orbit, there's tiny little flecks, maybe the size of beach sand, up to little gravel size, and maybe more. And I've watched it for 40-some years, and I can tell you, it really can produce some interesting displays.
We've been hearing a lot about this NASA Perseverance rover that's on Mars.
Yes.
What is this Perseverance rover, and what's the big deal with this guy?
Well, perseverance is something interesting. Look at the technology. As I mentioned before, it's like landing on the surface of Mars, like you're shooting a bullet from New York and hitting a bullseye to land in or hit the target in Los Angeles. Perseverance has done amazing things. It got there. It's a very complicated series, as we've talked about in the past, of how you descend those 7 to 10 minutes of hell, as they say, going through the Martian atmosphere. The same problem when people come back from space. It's dangerous if you don't have the right equipment. Kudos to NASA. They soft-landed on the surface. The object has been doing many, many explorations and running around. They call them sols, S-O-Ls, not days on the surface of Mars, because Mars's day is about 37 minutes longer than the Earth day. And out of it, even more incredible, comes this little foldable type of little drone, which is called Ingenuity, and it's been doing flawless flights. I think they've gotten it up to a mile away from the mothership. And that alone is just incredible at an object right now that's about 240 million miles away from the Earth. The Chinese have done the same thing. Again, they're the only nation in the world that's to date has not only done an orbiter, a lander, and a rover all in one shebang. We took a long time to do this ourselves, but to all the scientists out there that are doing this, Frank, that's amazing stuff. We live in amazing times. I feel so great for the young children that have the chance to study this, do STEM and STEAM programs. The future looks bright, and of course we want to be optimistic in times when there's so many reasons that people could go off the track and think of negativity.
The voice you've been hearing has been Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. He is a veteran radio and television broadcaster, and they call him an edutainer, and he is someone with a great deal of expertise in astronomy and space. If you want to hear more of him, you can go to ktar.com. That's ktar.com. We also learned, Steve, recently about this, that Blue Origin wants to build this human lunar lander on the moon at the price of about $2 billion. They've apparently offered NASA this $2 billion. Usually, a lot of other folks have said this generally goes through a standard RFP process. What Blue Origin is doing with this this lunar lander, is that different from how space usually works when it comes to private-public partnerships?
Oh, no, and you got to look at it this way. God bless the people who work at NASA. They're trying to get their project going. It's a government project. But when you have people come in, like we were mentioning Bezos and Branson, and you have, of course, Musk coming in there, this is a different kind of challenge. So I know there's a little bit of infighting and there's a little bit of politics here, but, you know, let's not go with the lowest bidder always. And I think in this case, we probably are going to see some amazing designs. Imagine that flight going to the moon. Not only will men and women walk the surface of the moon, it'll become regular and commonplace probably within the next 50 years. And you know what I would love to do? I would love, I don't know about you, and I think you'd agree, I would love to go right back to the Apollo 11 landing site and put to rest any concerns that anybody ever had about the fact that we faked the landings on the moon. I don't believe it was a Capricorn 1 movie like they would see the movie. I don't think that at all. I mean, I've talked to these people. I haven't been there. Could it be possible that I've been lied to or we've all been lied to? I don't think so, Frank. What do you think? I think we were there, and I'd love to just see the lunar landing of Apollo 11 and the spacecraft here in Arizona, the LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. Check that out, folks. Go to Arizona State University's LRO webpage, and they already have images from low lunar orbit where this little thing about the size of a refrigerator has been going around the moon imaging it. They have the descent module. They have the footprints. They have the lunar rover tracks of the Apollo astronauts and the tracks that they made. I don't know. I don't think that's Photoshop to you.
You know, I'm a guy that loves to indulge in and even sometimes encourage conspiracy theories late at night on the radio. But that's one that I find even a little too incredulous, even for me. Steve, as is always the case, whenever we speak, we are just about out of time. I very much appreciate you being so generous with your time. And I'm very much looking forward to our next conversation.
I look forward to it. I thank you. And good morning to all the listeners of 77W. ABC. Thank you, Frank.
Absolutely. The great Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. Check him out on ktar.com, a man who I believe may have the best voice in radio, and we're lucky to have him contribute to this show from time to time and on the Cats Roundtable from time to time. What an intellect and what a voice. All right. We are just getting started. Coming up in about a half hour, we're going to talk with somebody who's an expert in shadow people. Now, I didn't even know what shadow people was before I started doing research on them. But it's pretty fascinating. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, though, fascinating discussion I heard yesterday about non-disclosure agreements. If you're involved in a non-disclosure agreement, should that be for life or should you get to break it? We'll explore it. Until then, keep asking questions.